Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show here on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This portion of the morning show is going to be spent previewing for you a really special event which is coming up at Carthage this weekend. It's the J-Term Opera Workshop performance, and it's a double bill of two one-act operas. One of them is by a very well-known operatic composer, Giacomo Puccini, famous for La Bohème, Tosca, Madame Butterfly. And it's a one-act opera of his called Sur Angelica, one of his most exquisite scores and one of the most heartbreaking stories that he ever set. The second half of this double bill is by a brand-new opera composer, namely me, but with a very experienced and skilled librettist who has put together the text that forms the framework for this other opera called Black September. We're going to be talking about that on this portion of the morning show, and my guest is Matt Barresi, the man who has shaped the libretto for this new opera, Black September. Matt is an instructor at Carthage in both music and theater courses, and in addition to all the work that he does at Carthage and other places in the realm of opera and music theater, Matt is also a professional librettist with almost a dozen different librettos to his credit for operas and musicals both. So he brought a seasoned hand to the task of creating this new one-act opera. In a nutshell, the reason an opera was created was because we were committed to doing Puccini's Sur Angelica, which is for an all-female cast, but we had very talented male singers as well who were interested in being part of something in the J-Term Opera. So that's where the maybe crazy idea was hatched of actually creating an opera in which we would cast these male singers. And Black September, the title, is because it is based on the tragic events that were part of the Munich Olympic Games of 1972, when, as many of you remember, 11 Israeli athletes and coaches were kidnapped by Palestinian terrorists and ultimately killed. It's still by far the most tragic outbreak of violence that has ever occurred in any Olympic Games. And Matt Barresi, my partner, the librettist for Black September, has done an enormous amount of research into the events that surrounded the Munich Olympics and brought a lot of that expertise and know-how into the crafting of this libretto. So first of all, Matt Barresi, in the middle of a busy day, thank you for joining me on the morning show.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Before we talk about the shaping of this specific story of Black September, I thought it would be interesting to maybe try to give people a little insight into what is so challenging about shaping the libretto of, especially an opera, and for that matter, for a musical. I think probably most people assume it's just, well, you take a good play or you take a good story and trim it up a little or something, but then you just write music to it. And, of course, the shaping of a libretto is a much more complicated thing. So tell us whatever you want to about the craft of writing librettos.
Well, sure. Well, I do think that writing libretto is its own bag, its own specific craft, and someone who is doing their due diligence when writing an opera is, in fact, making sure that the subject matter works for opera, that it has grand passions enough to be sung with those big voices, and that the ideas are large enough and clear enough that when sung with big voices, no nuance will be lost and that the bigness will be justified. So, obviously, a piece like Black September, a piece that's about a hostage situation and a massacre, about people fighting for their homeland, people murdering for their homeland, people who are victims representing their homeland. Everybody is very emotionally charged in the piece. So that helps warrant the big singing of opera. Then when you write the libretto, you have to, what you have to do is get out of the way. People say, oh, isn't it awful to be a librettist because nobody knows your name? I mean, when people, you know, in the future, when people talk about Black September, they will refer to it as Greg Berg's Black September. And I'm okay with that. I'm certainly not without ego, but I appreciate that part of the librettist's job is to facilitate the music, facilitate the singing, facilitate the composition, and then get out of the way. I say it's actually most akin to writing for a comic book, because you figure you can only fit so many words in that little word balloon, and then you really have to let the story be told by the penciler who's drawing the superheroes. So I consider it a welcome challenge that I really enjoy to say, how can I find the mot juste, the just the right word, and the fewest number of words possible to facilitate that big sound, to spark the creative juices of the composer, and then get out of the way. Go to the back row of the auditorium and watch it happen.
How did you get started writing librettos? And was that a dramatic departure from whatever else you were doing at the time, or almost from the start of your adult life? Is this something you aspired to do?
I think in the 20th and 21st century, I don't know that anybody starts thinking about being a librettist. I think that's several steps in the process. And myself, and I'd say most librettists that I know, and there's not many. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like being a buggy whip manufacturer or something. You start as a writer and or an actor, right? I mean, if we take this all the way back to high school, I think most people who are now librettists did some musicals in their high school and wrote. And then maybe you do some music, and you probably find opera in college. Most people don't do much opera in high school. So you find it. So for me, I started to perform a little bit of opera, not well, in undergrad, and start to go see operas. I saw some operas as a youth, but started to see a lot in undergrad. And then by the time I got to graduate school, I was so hooked on opera and saw so many operas that I was already writing musicals. I think most people who write operas are already writing musicals, and they suddenly become attracted to the scale and the scope and the richness and the history of opera, and they want to write that. So by the time I got to graduate school, I went to a musical theater writing program, but I knew that I wanted to focus that program, to customize that program to be for writing opera. And so you just have to make sure that you find composers who are like-minded and start to write with them. So then by the time I was out of graduate school, I was formally focused and trained on writing opera. Mm. And I think that's the arc for most people who are writing opera now. You start with musical theater, and you love opera, and then you step over it there.
This is our first collaboration doing this. We've co-directed all kinds of productions, but never written anything together like this, an entirely original work. I think at least most of the operas you've composed before now have been for a particular composer whose name is escaping me right now. But tell us about that particular partnership.
Sure. Peter Hilliard, he's based in Philadelphia, and he and I write most of our work. We do work with other collaborators as well, but the largest part of our oeuvre so far has been together. He went to graduate school with me, and he had just come out of Peabody and wanted to be was a classical composer and wanted to write operas. So we paired up in grad school and said, let's write opera together. So we have, and we've had a good deal of success. We had a big premiere last year in Washington, D.C. called Blue Viola, and Blue Viola will have a few productions this year. And our piece, The Filthy Habit, which is a comic piece, will go up in Chicago and the Chicago Fringe Festival with Third Eye Ensemble in September. What I think helped you and I collaborate is that I think we have a lot of similar tastes in opera and a similar mode of operation. And I think that you, like Peter, both of you guys have a certain appreciation for numbers, for discrete pieces of music within the opera. So now in a modern opera, it's not quite so clear as a musical. It's not like everyone's talking and then an intro starts and you go, oh, a song is coming, and the song happens and the song ends and everyone claps and you move on. It's never quite that discreet in late 20th century and 21st century opera, but there is a difference between some operas that seem to just be a wash of music and words that never kind of loop back or don't have a particular structure, and things that do feel like, oh, okay, that was an aria. Ah, that was definitely a duet. And I've already known from working with you on other pieces that we share an appreciation for an opera that has a definite profile. I think it's an audience-friendly thing. I think that audiences want to know where they are in the piece. I think the human brain wants to know where it is in a piece, wants to feel a profile, wants to feel a structure, wants to say, ah, we are drilling down into an idea with one or a smaller number of characters. Ah, now we are in a scene where a lot of people are expressing themselves musically. So I think the fact that you and I share that value allowed us to create a piece incredibly quickly and without incident.
I know that you've done an enormous amount of research about this incident in the Munich Olympics, and I know that even going into this, you were already acquainted with what had happened there. In the phase of studying it and learning more about it, what are the most significant things you learned that had a direct impact on how you shaped this libretto, on how it shaped the story that you ultimately wanted to tell?
Sure. Well, yeah, I have a long history with this subject because my parents were living in Germany when it went down. That was a few years before I was born. But my dad was stationed in Germany as a U.S. Army member. And so even as a little kid, they told me that some bad stuff had gone down in Germany when they were living there, and that it was a really politically charged time. And a lot of what led to this disaster, obviously there were, as there always seemed to be, problems in the Middle East. And so the Black September Group was a cell of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and they wanted to bring attention to their cause, so they kidnapped many Israeli athletes. The tragic thing is that because there were so many political things happening in the air at the time, it was the height of the Cold War. Germany had fairly recently been split. So East Germany and West Germany had a lot of problems with one another, politically speaking. There was the Cold War U.S.-Russian thing that was playing out in Germany. There was fear of, this was really a time when the African colonies and Central Asian colonies were pushing back on the European forces. So basically, the Germans, the Dutch, the Portuguese, the English, the French were all getting pushed out of their colonies in Africa. So there was a fear of Afrocentrism and anti-imperial notions. There was a fear in Germany of American black power. They were afraid that maybe American black GIs would cause a ruckus. What else were they afraid of? The Bader-Meinhof gang. There were communist gangs that were blowing things up all around Germany. And, of course, there were neo-Nazis who wanted to see things back to the way they were about 30 years prior. So, unfortunately, the German response to all that stuff was to say, we want to show the world that we are not Hitler's Germany. Because if you think about the last time the Olympics had been in Germany, it was the 1936, the Hitler Olympics. So they said, okay, we're living in a violent world. We want to show that we're not violent anymore. So let's have a noticeable lack of security. Let's have no guns. Let's have no jackbooted troopers about. So they staffed the place with a small number of docents in baby blue leisure suits and, they just didn't have enough security. They didn't want it to look like, you know, razor wire and machine gun nests. Unfortunately, they should have been thinking about the Bader-Meinhof gangs and PLOs of the world because look what happened. And they were just absolutely ill-equipped, unequipped to deal with the hostage situation. They did not have a sport. It's not what you'd think of the Germans now or then. No special forces, no anti-terrorist groups, no SWAT teams, no G.I. Joe to burst in and kick down doors and come down on grappling hooks. They did not know how to deal with a hostage situation.
One of the choices you made was to have us meet a number of these athletes and coaches and three of the terrorists, and then one German, a German official named Dietrich Genscher, who serves as kind of a narrator as he remembers these events with great sorrow and regret. What prompted you to make that particular choice, to create that kind of framework with, in a sense, a narrator taking us through the story? Did anything in particular attract you to that idea?
I think as we were studying, as you and I were studying, as we were studying with the kids, because obviously this is an academic journey, so they should, you know, they were a part of the journey of discovery with us. The Germans, whenever this story is recounted, the Germans really come off as buffoons at best and callous at worst. But I don't know that many emotionally healthy humans are different from one another. So what does it mean to be a German bureaucrat who has this huge disaster happen in a country that is trying to show the world that they don't make a mess of things anymore, and they make a mess the other way? Instead of being cruel, they come off as incompetent. There's got to be a high emotional toll for allowing all these men to be murdered on your soil in a really grisly way, and one could say due to your own poor response. So I thought that attitude had an operatic scale sense of guilt and regret that should be represented. And dealing with the terrorists, that's a tough one. I mean, the athletes themselves, they're Olympic athletes. They're proud, strong men who are put in a horrible situation, terrifying situation. So their opera is going to come out of them. And then you have to represent the terrorists, and that's a hot potato. I mean, you've seen other operas have trouble voicing terrorists in a way that can keep everybody happy, because certainly if you're going to represent the Palestinians, you don't want to do it in a way that could be construed as racist. I mean, you can't say, well, these aren't humans, these are evil jackals. Well, that's not okay to say about any, particularly any group, let alone any individual. These guys who committed these atrocities weren't nice guys. I mean, it's very hard to be, I think you could be maybe sympathetic to the origins of the PLO's cause, but I think that probably the guys who self-selected to go take hostages had a psychopathic streak, I mean, clinically speaking. So these were vicious guys who tortured these athletes and shot them, and were capable of doing that and seemed to do it with very little hesitation or regret. So how do you say, hey, there's bad guys in the world and these are some bad dudes, without saying the Palestinians of this world have no legitimate beef, or all Palestinians are bad? How do you balance that? I think we have, but it's certainly a challenge when writing.
Another challenge, it seems to me, was that given that the story is such a tragedy, it would be probably the simplest thing to create a libretto that was unrelentingly grim. And one of the things that impresses me is the way you have shaped this story. It is not just dripping with sorrow and sadness on every single page, that there's a wider emotional range here than you might possibly expect, given the story and just its tragic dimensions. Was that difficult? I mean, did you struggle with how to make this as emotionally varied a libretto as it is?
It was a challenge. I think it was one that maybe you and I are particularly equipped for. Most of what I've written is comedy. So going to the well and making, like, drawing up jokes is not particularly difficult. Of course, the trouble is, how do you have humor in a piece that is about something so serious? It's hard to tell from an interview with two academics on the radio, but you and I are really happy guys. Like, we laugh and joke and have a good time when we're teaching together and working together. So we're not the type who would want to sit through nor create an unrelentingly violent or dark or hopeless piece. And I think philosophically we don't believe in hopeless cases, and we wouldn't want to subject the audience to it. So you have to look, this is a piece, I think we created a world where we could flash back and flash forward and flash sideways and look at happier times in these guys' lives, happier than when you're a hostage, right? Or even show the way guys in close quarters rib one another or create comedy in almost any situation. So we had to look for, where would the guys try to break the tension? Or when they look back at happy times, let's make those happy times come to life so that the piece is not not a slog or doesn't say, hey, everybody in the audience, give up because life is terrible. You know, how do you look at a terrible moment but not have the philosophy of the piece be everything is terrible?
Mm. Yeah, I love the way that you ultimately created this libretto in a way that the story is ultimately much more uplifting and inspiring and hopeful than the events themselves might perhaps suggest. What does it feel like to anticipate the first performance, the unveiling of something that you've written? I mean, unlike, well, I've had that experience with maybe individual pieces, but never with, you know, a big work like this. You've been in this situation before. Approaching a premiere, do you usually have a pretty good sense of how effective something is and how well it's going to go, or is it really hard to know until it's performed the first time and you see how an audience receives it? I mean, has your career been full of very many surprises in that respect?
I don't think I've had any bad surprises, at least not in my sort of adult, like outside of my juvenilia. I think for the most part I've thought this piece is more good than bad, and the audience will at least like it, and then that has borne out that pieces have been largely successful. You have to be excited about a premiere. You wouldn't go into this if you wouldn't compose and you wouldn't write if you weren't excited about premieres. But you can't know how it's going to be on that first night because you're too close to it. And even the singers, even the people who go through the process. I mean, there's umpteen guys in this piece, and there's you and I. We've been working on it for months, but that's almost deleterious to the situation of knowing whether it's good or not, because you're so close to the page. You've made all the choices, hopefully in good faith, and I'm making this choice because I think it's the choice that's going to work. But you're so darn close to it, you could be horribly. I mean, anybody who's ever written a piece that was a massive failure and people booed and walked out, and people do boo in opera, so that's the thing. You don't want to drop the ball in opera because they'll tell you. They didn't say, oh man, this piece is going to be terrible on opening night. Everybody thinks it's going to be good. So you have to second guess yourself. I do think people are going to enjoy this piece. Now, we wrote it quickly, and pieces take years to develop. I don't mean just the research and writing. That takes a long time. But the initial premiere of almost any work is not the way it ends up. Even things that premiere at the Met or the Lyric before they go on to another production, things are tweaked and things are changed. So I know what people see are going to come to see this weekend is not what they will see should we remount this or if somebody else does it. Things will change. And things, you know, things will get better. So am I scared? Yeah, sure. Yeah. Because an opera is so, everything about opera is big. So if you make mistakes, they're pretty big, too. And when the subject matter is serious, you don't want to make a mistake that makes it seem silly. So I'm nervous. Of course I'm nervous. But I'm confident that it will be at least largely successful. And, of course, I hope it will be wildly impossibly successful.
Say a quick word about the 11 guys that comprise our cast and to what extent they have maybe even surprised you by what they have managed to accomplish in this ridiculously short amount of time.
Well, they've learned their music very fast. And I don't know, to the listener, I don't know if that seems impressive or not, but it's difficult music. It's all music. I mean, you don't just learn a three-minute song every 15 minutes of text, right? It's all sung, and it's all 20th, what we refer to as 20th century music, but 21st century music, which is more complicated than, you know, just a typical, like a folk song or a rock, you know, pop song on the radio. Like, it's thornier than that to learn. They've learned it very quickly, and they've had to spend their gray southern Wisconsin January with a very heavy subject matter. And I think there's a particular profile, at least right now there is, to the students that we deal with at Carthage. They're good guys. They're big-hearted guys. They're emotionally vulnerable and emotionally open and generous guys. So right from the beginning, they really felt a lot of sympathy for the victims of this massacre. They wanted to tell this story, and they did tons of research themselves, and they've really dedicated themselves to an honest and powerful portrayal. So while they are on a technical level, learning lots and lots of very hard music and having to do blocking and so forth, which is sometimes tricky, you know, fight scene type stuff, as they go, they're also having to bear the emotional burden of an extremely heavy story that you have to enter. I mean, you have to play this character. So it means every day you come to class and you have to pretend you're these guys and try to believe you're in this horrifying situation hour after hour after hour. And that really, if you are doing it effectively and connecting to the material, it's a heavy cross to bear. And they have thrown themselves into it so generously, and I'm so proud of them and so excited for what they've done. Good, good guys.
Black September receives its world premiere performances this weekend, Friday night, Saturday night, 7:30 p.m. at Siebert Chapel, and admission is free. Matt Barresi, thank you.
Thank you.
Again, to reiterate, the double bill of Puccini's Sur Angelica and the world premiere of Black September is this weekend, Friday night and Saturday night at Carthage's Siebert Chapel. These free performances open to the public are at 7:30, each performance followed by an audience talkback where you have the opportunity to pose questions to any of the participants. My thanks to Matt Barresi for joining me for part one of today's morning show. Part two about anxiety will be coming up in just a moment. The time is 8:35. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Looks like due to technical difficulties, we won't be able to bring you that conversation about anxiety I was looking forward to sharing with you in part two of today's program. In its place, we're going to share with you the opening of an interview which is going to be airing in its entirety next Tuesday. It takes us inside the imposing gauntlet of the Iditarod with someone who successfully ran the Iditarod in her late 40s for the first time. Quick word about our weather forecast here in southeastern Wisconsin. Mostly cloudy and seasonal temperatures today, a high of 29 degrees, overnight low of 19. Tomorrow, under partly sunny skies, a high of 30 degrees. Part two now of today's morning show here on WGTD. We are off to the frigid winds of Alaska today and to the excitement and incredible test of endurance, which is the Iditarod. And perhaps you have heard at least a little bit about this daunting gauntlet, which is a dog sled race like none other. And we get to experience the punishing challenge which the Iditarod represents in an amazing new book called Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. This is something which Debbie Motoreau experienced at the age of 47 as a mother of two. And it was not an easy thing to accomplish, but accomplish it she did. And as she shares the story with us in this exciting book, we come to know and love each and every one of these dogs that made this possible.
Debbie Modaro actually ran the Iditarod more than once, and dog racing runs deep into her family. And we hear about that as well, and some other really touching personal stories as well. There is so much that makes this an incredibly compelling book. Again, it's called Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And Debbie Clark Modaro, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to talk to you this morning.
Glad that we can do this. Could you very briefly sketch your life's path, which eventually took you to Alaska?
You bet. I grew up in New England, spent a lot of time in Vermont, Cape Cod. My parents took me to Wyoming. Wild places were definitely the favorite in our household, all generations. And when I graduated from college, I did move to Wyoming. I was invited on a climbing expedition, a mountain climbing expedition in Alaska, and I went to Alaska for what I thought would be 10 days. I met my husband on that trip. We got married the following winter, and Alaska's been our home ever since 1979, when all that happened.
I wonder if we could just take a moment to have you sketch one of the most interesting and harrowing stories which occurs that has nothing to do with dog sledding, but has a lot to do with the perils of Alaska. It involves your fall into a crevice and suffering some serious injuries, and you actually were probably lucky. That story could have ended much worse than it did.
I was very, very lucky. I had just spent a much more technical time climbing in the Alaska Range, which is in formerly Mount McKinley, Denali, climbing and skiing on the glaciers. And Mark and I went on what was supposed to be a day excursion into the mountains, and we were walking on a glacier before it got steep, and I slipped and fell into a crevasse unroped. And I don't even like telling this story because it was definitely one of my it's a little embarrassing looking back. Of course, I was young, immortal. We were about to rope up. There didn't seem to be any danger before that. But, boy, that was a wake-up call to me, that I was incredibly lucky to come out of that one alive.
Well, it obviously didn't ultimately tame your sense of adventure, because ultimately, of course, you end up experiencing an extraordinary kind of adventure that most of us can scarcely even dream of. How did dog racing first enter sort of the collective life of your small family, of you and your husband and your two children there in Alaska?
Well, we adopted a retired Iditarod sled dog, and we fell madly in love with this dog. His name was Salt. Our children were 5 and 6 at the time, I believe. And Salt really took us on skis. He would tow the kids behind him. He would tow me behind him. The sport is called ski touring, where you ski behind a dog, and it's pulling you. And before you know it, our children wanted more dogs so they could go into little junior races, the one dog class, the two dog class. They got older. There was the 3 and 5 dog class. So the numbers of huskies grew in our household.
I wonder
how it all began.
Right. I think it is really telling that, and it is part of what makes this book really remarkable, that you tell us the point in your life when this beautiful dog named Salt came into your life. It came at a very, very low point when you and your husband had suffered something truly heartbreaking. Can you just say a quick word about that?
You bet. I had just experienced a well into my pregnancy miscarriage, and I was pretty down in the dumps. It actually happened to me 3 times, and it really threw me. You know, I'm pretty resilient, and I know that no one is immune from life's heartaches, so I really tried to work through it. But Salt was actually a present, a gift to me from a friend who was a musher, knowing that I was kind of in a dark place, and he thought that the dog might might turn my world around, and I don't think he had any idea how what the dog would do to all of us.
Right. You recount the story of when Salt first came into your house, literally, and you were very resistant to the idea, and yet Salt did something which caused you to laugh for the first time in months.
Salt walked. I told our friend not to come over, and he said, "I'm coming. If you don't like this dog, you can return him to me in a week. Just, we're coming. My wife and I are coming over. We're bringing you this dog." And my mother was visiting, and she said, "Oh, what do you want an old husky for? I bet he's not even housebroken." Well, that got the rebel in me going a little. I said, "Of course he's housebroken, Mom," knowing full well he probably wasn't. And he came in the door, trotted right to the Christmas tree, and lifted his leg. And that was the beginning of our life with Salt.
Right. And I think it's really interesting in a slightly later chapter when you talk about Salt being, in a sense, a mentor to younger dogs. But also he represented for you something else, of course, kind of a path out of your deepest sorrow. At one point you say, "To Salt I confided my deep maternal sorrow." And I think, mm-hmm. you know, even for someone who's not been exactly where you are or experienced what you were experiencing then, I think just about any of us who own dogs that we love and who we feel love us have experienced at least something like that.
Yeah, well, I remember this vividly, actually. It's not in the book, but there was a day right in there when Salt ran off one day, and I was absolutely devastated. Well, he turned out he was at the neighbor's house looking for their chickens, but that dog was very, very sacred to me. He really was. For, you know, he represents the beginning of our kennel, which has sustained us in many different times and ways and adventures, but boy, that bond with Salt was something I will never, ever forget.
Hmm. We are speaking with Debbie Clark Motoro, and we're talking about her new book, Fast Into the Night, A Woman, Her Dogs, and Their Journey North on the Iditarod Trail. It was actually your son, Andy, who experienced the wonder and joy and glory of running an Iditarod well before you did. And you tell us about his experience and how exhilarating it was for him to finish. And his words to you at the finish line when you first embraced were what?
He said to me, I watched my son run under the Burled Arch in Nome, the finish line. I had never dreamt of doing Iditarod, and I was so thrilled with the smile on his face. His dogs were just charging and happy. He threw his arms around me, and he said, "Mom, you have to do this." And honestly, I had never, ever thought of running Iditarod before. I was busy raising kids, having fun in shorter races. Mark and I loved to go camping with the dogs. We introduced some friends to the sport. But when Andy said that, I think that the whole lifestyle, our dogs had meant so much to us. Both Andy and his sister Hannah were going off to college in the next 2 years, leaving 22 dogs in the backyard. And I thought, by golly, I guess I will. That was the beginning of my Iditarod journey.
Say a quick word about the creation of the Iditarod in 1973. I think it says something about the race and the mystique that surrounds it that a lot of us sort of just assume that this has been around for hundreds of years. I mean, there is something sort of primeval about what this experience is and what an accomplishment it is to complete it successfully. It's actually a relatively new creation. Tell us just a brief word about its creation and how it stands apart from other dog races.
Well, Joe Reddington had this great interest in the dogs of the North and mostly in the trail that had been used for centuries that crossed Alaska. It had been used for many different purposes. The most famous might be the Serum Run delivery in 1925. But dogs had been used in this northern land long before that to help the native people of Alaska live in the winter, trapping and moving, and really for transportation. And, of course, the Gold Rush history is another aspect of the dogs and the trail. Joe Reddington wanted to honor that tradition, and toward that end, he started the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. Now it's really taken on a life of its own. But it was really to honor the dogs and the land.
Explain exactly how the race works, sort of the nuts and bolts of it.
You bet. You start the first Saturday of March. Iditarod starts every year. You follow a course that is marked by 22 checkpoints between here and Nome, Alaska, which is on the coast of the Bering Sea. I'm in Anchorage this morning. You have some mandatory rests that you need to take along the way. There's a 24-hour mandatory rest. There's several other rests that you need to take. But basically, each musher starts with, these days, 16 dogs, and it's up to you to train for your particular race in a run-rest schedule that you devise with your team in months and months and usually thousands of miles training in preparation for it. At every checkpoint, there are veterinarians. Dogs are given physicals every stop along the way. You can, what we call, drop dogs. You can leave dogs in the hands of veterinarians to fly home if they're tired, if they have maybe a sore wrist or something. The point is to leave them in good hands and get them home safe and sound before a soreness really turns into a real injury. And you can proceed, but you cannot add any dogs to your team.
One other detail,
you send provisions out to each of those 22 checkpoints. So you're picking up supplies for you and the dogs along the way.
So in a sense, you're picking up your own provisions.
Absolutely. Picking up human food, dog food, extra gear, whatever it is that you use to care for the animals.
And these are provisions that you have purchased and arranged for and sent ahead.
That's right. It's called drop bags. You send them out in drop bags. And the deadline when drop bags actually are the blueprint for your race. What you send out there is what you have. Those are your resources to get from point A in Anchorage to 1,000 miles later to Nome.
One little point of complication, in a sense, is the fact that you were heading out on this Iditarod with a team of 16 dogs. And explain to our listeners how this marked a somewhat dramatic departure from what you were used to.
Well, I weigh 120 pounds, so 16 dogs is not a number of dogs I casually run in training. You know, I'm usually running an 8, 10, maybe a 12-dog team. So, but you start with 16 on a trip of this length because, you know, you want to have enough dogs so that in the end you have a good, strong team if you have to leave a few. The key to this whole thing is your relation to the dogs and the dogs' relation to one another. And you bring with you on that line a bunch of circumstances and familiarities for yourself and the dogs, but then there's some unknowns. What's it like to be out there for 14 days running at all times of the day? What's it like on the Bering Sea coast when there isn't a tree in sight and you can't tell which way is up, down, or sideways? What's it like in a wind that's hurricane strength? You might or might not run into that. You don't normally train in that sort of a circumstance. So there's a very, very intimate dynamic between the musher and the dogs, and then a big set of variables about what you might experience out there and how collectively you'll deal with that.
One of the things that was really odd about this first Iditarod that you ran or run, I'm not sure what the verb is I'm supposed to use.
No, we use ran.
Okay. although it's mostly the dogs who do the running, of course. But this was a case in which, for the first time in the race's 30-year history, it was 30 years old at that point, the trail, which had always been, I think, essentially the exact same trail, had to be changed, and rather dramatically changed. Explain what the trail usually is, but what the trail turned out to be in 2003.
Usually the trail begins in South Central Alaska near Anchorage and goes up and over the Alaska Range in the first 200 miles. Then it follows the Yukon River, and then it goes along the coast to Nome. There was no snow that winter, much like last winter. And so the race was relocated to begin in Fairbanks. That's north of the mountain range, So the race took place entirely on rivers for the most part until the coast. There was no crossing of the treacherous country that there usually is in the beginning. And river running is relatively mild, but it is somewhat monotonous for that many miles.
And it's interesting because that also that monotony posed some real challenges in terms of being able to successfully and safely complete the course. I mean, monotony can be your enemy.
It was interesting that year. The rate of teams that pulled out of the race when they were still on the river was incredibly high. And most mushers agreed that it was really the lack of variety. You know, the Yukon River is mile wide in places. And to do that day after day after day really did take its toll on the morale of mushers and their dogs. And, of course, the dogs are reflecting the mushers' swings and vice versa. And so it's difficult to really understand what happens when a dog team loses their drive, but the fallout rate on that race was very, very high. Hmm.
Deborah Clark Motoreau, she is the author of this really, really fascinating book called Fast Into the Night, which recounts her really ultimately harrowing experience of being part of the famous Iditarod race in Alaska. We're going to be airing this interview in its entirety on Tuesday's morning show. Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll have some football-related interviews for you on the eve, of course, of the 50th Super Bowl, including a conversation with someone from Sports Illustrated who helped edit a spectacular new book all about the history of the Super Bowl and its 50 years of existence. On Monday's morning show, I look forward to welcoming into the studios two faculty colleagues from Carthage College, Jeff Roberg and Penny Seymour, to talk about the recent trip which they took to Cuba with a group of students, and several of their students will be joining them as well. And we will hear about some of the intriguing changes which are afoot in the nation of Cuba, a nation with which, of course, the United States, for the first time in many, many years, is beginning to enjoy at least something of a more normal diplomatic relationship. We will be talking about that on Monday's morning show. We remind you that the morning show archive can be found on WGTD's website, wgtd.org. The archive is located right on the front page, very, very easy to find. So seek it out if there is a morning show interview that you missed and want to hear, or an interview that you listened to and want to hear again. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. We're about to join Wisconsin Public Radio for their classical music programming for the balance of the morning. Dave McGrath returns at 12 noon to update you on all the latest news on today's Midday Report, followed, of course, by Chapter a Day, more classical music, and NPR's All Things Considered, beginning at 3 o'clock with a full recap of all the day's most important news. Now to the WGTD weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. For today, mostly cloudy skies and seasonal temperatures, a high today of about 29 degrees. It will be cloudy and cold overnight with an overnight low of 19 degrees. Tomorrow, Friday, should be partly sunny with a high of 30 degrees. On Saturday, cloudier skies and a high of 36 degrees. Super Bowl Sunday is going to be cloudy with a high of 40. Not quite as warm on Monday and Tuesday, and each day we have around a 30 to 40% chance of light snow. This is WGTD.